People Helping People, a program bridging the community with local organizations and nonprofits making a difference in the Bay Area. If you or someone you know would like to get your messages on People Helping People, please email us at contact@poly923fm.com or theycpeoplehelpingpeople@gmail.com. Here are your hosts, Larry Walling and Greg Pirillo.
Hello and welcome to People Helping People on Bali 92.3 FM. My name is Greg, my co-host Larry.
Good morning.
It's good to be with you, my friend.
Thank you. Good to be back.
I can honestly say we've seen a major shift in the feeling, you know, it's feeling like autumn, right?
The weather.
Although it got kind of reverted back to hot days towards the end of the week, or at least when we recorded this, it was supposed to happen that way.
Yeah.
But it's been nice to kind of get that feeling of autumn. And what we know is when it happens at this time of year, there's a lot more activity in the community as far as nonprofit events.
True, yeah.
The holiday season coming up with Diwali and Dandiyas all happening. And then you have Thanksgiving and Halloween and Christmas. There's a lot of stuff in the back end of the year, three months, right?
Lots.
So we know at this time when kids are getting back to school, parents are getting more involved in what's happening in their kids' world, whether it be, you know, school system stuff or like the old educational side of things, but also when it comes to educating people on specific topics. And I think today we're going to delve into a topic that's dear to you, also something that's very, very misunderstood and something that is really just finding its way to the mainstream. And we're not even sure how to approach this. So this is going to be very exciting to have today's guest, Joe Ellis of the Bay Area Lyme Foundation. Is that right?
Yep.
You are the Director of Education Outreach, which I couldn't understand that title until I met you.
No. Oh.
Now I know why they have you in that particular role, because you are very, very good at communicating. And it seems to me you will help people understand what this is all about. Can you give us a little background on, can you give me something about Lyme that would sum it up for somebody who's never heard this before?
Well, Lyme, thanks for your kind words and thanks for having me. Lyme is a disease that is very misunderstood, and it's very complicated. To a lot of people, it's not just one disease. It's actually a whole clustering of different illnesses that all gets bundled into this one moniker of Lyme. And so I'm looking forward to talking to everybody today and hopefully shedding some light on
Lyme.
The murky world of Lyme.
It's strange because first of all, it's spelled L-Y-M-E. And I always wondered why. Was it the person? What's the reason?
The first recorded cases of Lyme disease were actually found in Old Lyme, Connecticut.
Really?
Yeah, back in the 1970s. There was this very strange clustering or outbreak of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. That's what they thought it was at the time.
Right.
And it was all clustered in this one little location.
Ironically, right off of the heel of Long Island, by the way, right across the water. You could throw a baseball to the land in Connecticut from Long Island. It's very close.
Yeah. And so what happened was there was a group of moms, actually, which we'll kind of come back to because that kind of has a connection to Bay Area Lyme Foundation. But it was a group of moms, and they were like, this is not right. Our kids are getting sick. It doesn't make any sense. Why are they coming down with this terrible, you know, illness that makes their joints swell to the point where people were in wheelchairs, young people, teenagers. And so fast forward a little bit, in around about 1982, the government, people, the local health, they got onto it and said, we've got to figure out what's going on. But anyway, eventually back in 1982, a scientist called Dr. Willy Bergdorfer, who was quite a famous character in the world of Lyme disease, he actually was able to isolate the particular bacteria that was causing they believed was causing Lyme, and it ended up that very specific bacteria is now called Borrelia burgdorferi after Dr. Willy Burgdorfer, because he identified this particular pathogen.
Wow.
That's
incredible knowledge that you're able to retain that, knowing as much as you do, and you retained all that little, just that alone is amazing and impressive. Can I ask you, I want Larry to tell the story of his daughter, because I think it'll be a good, relatable understanding of what you deal with the disease. But what I wanted to ask is, there's a lot of, like I said, I guess, talk about where the disease came from, why it's not recognized technically by the government. There's a lot of questions in there, and I don't want to necessarily get into any of the politics of it. What I'd like to understand is it a man-made disease as many people believe it is? Is it something they were using to study some for some form of whatever that turned into an outbreak, almost like because somebody was careless? Or is there beyond that?
You know, there are so many different highly polarizing opinions about Lyme and the history of Lyme. One thing I do want to just loop back to, though, is to say that this disease is recognized by the CDC.
Okay.
It is. It's been studied by the CDC. It's recognized.
What's the CDC again?
The Centers for Disease Control.
Okay, thank you.
And so it's not actually technically, it's not actually accurate to say that it isn't recognized by the government.
Maybe health insurance.
It absolutely is. Yeah, we can come back to that later. But the thing about this bacteria, the Borrelia type of bacteria, there are many different strains of this bacteria. Mm-hmm. And the controversy really stems from, was this very specific strain, has it been in existence for millions and millions and millions of years? And there are many people who believe that there's a lot of scientific evidence, you know, for the fact that these particular types of bacteria have actually been around for even longer than our human species,
right?
Where the controversy really lies is this very specific strain of this bacteria that Dr. Willy Burgdorfer identified. And was it something that had been part of some kind of program, you know, back, you know, in the after the end of World War II, when, you know, people were sort of really getting into that kind of bioweaponry. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really somebody who's necessarily qualified to really parse that out. But what we do know is the Borrelia bacteria, which is this very specific kind of bacteria, has, and the family of Borrelias, have been around for millions of years. And there are Borrelias in Europe. There are Borrelias in South America. There are Borrelias in North America. They're China. Mm-hmm. These particular bacteria species are all over the world.
Okay.
Yeah. And the issue is, it's just kind of like the issue of Ebola, is what happens when a species goes from one animal or insect and then actually crosses into the human population.
Right.
And really that's where the crux of the challenge and the problem
lies.
That's
why there's so many different forms and so many different diagnoses. But people are so confused because it never shows itself the same way, which I wanted to talk about. So that brings me to this. Larry, can you give a quick version of what happened with your daughter?
Well, the reason why I'm so intimately involved in it is because we've talked about this, Greg and I, quite a lot, is that my daughter's become very ill with it. And she was diagnosed actually over 15 years after she was bitten by a tick. And that happened in Santa Barbara during one of the wildfires. It drove all the deer and animals out of the mountains, foothills, into the community of Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
And she was sleeping on the floor and was bitten in the head, apparently, by a tick. Some years later, she started to get ill with different types of things. They would treat those illnesses, but with little result. Finally, she found a doctor up in Portland who was treating her stomach gastroenterologist.
No. Gastroenterologist.
No.
Entero, I don't know.
It's a GI tract.
Yeah.
There.
I always get it wrong. I don't know why you'd ask me.
Anyway.
That. I'm the last person to ask
SIBO,
that.
SIBO. It's called SIBO. So she was treating for SIBO, but they weren't getting results with that either. Something to do with the stomach. But anyway, come to find out, she said, I want to do a Lyme test on you, the doctor said. So 2 weeks later, the results came back, and she was positive for that. Mm.
And she's been facing all different
kinds of
challenges and hardships
for a long, long time. So,
but it's nothing like the ones I've seen or people I've known who've had it. Her journey has been different and completely unique. And I know that's the case with a lot of diseases. Like, there's no one same kind of cancer. There is, but they work differently. Everybody's body's different.
Mm-hmm.
But where is it? Is it treatable? Are people, when people hear this, they get nervous because they're not really sure what it means. Is it going to change the quality of life? Is it going to change how they go about the rest of their lives? Can they be cured? Things like that. Where are we at with our knowledge of the disease itself? Do we feel it's close to a point where people can live a comfortable life with it? Or is it always a crapshoot?
An awful lot of questions in there.
Sorry, ton of questions. You could pick one
big,
if you'd like.
Big questions. Yeah. One thing I just want to go back
to
regarding what Larry just said is what we do know is that the average Lyme patient will see five doctors over an average of 2 years before they actually get an accurate diagnosis.
That's crazy.
And personally, one of the things that got me into the field was I was a middle school teacher for many years, and I had a pupil or student, as you would say here, who was prodigiously mathematically talented. Mm-hmm. And I was a Montessori teacher, and so I taught her for a 3-year cycle. And this is a kid who was doing calculus in seventh grade, right? So, you know, you're talking about somebody very special.
Right.
And over the course of that 3-year period, her whole health and her whole demeanor began to decline. Her mental health was really impacted. She was having a hard time with just general recall of information. She was very forgetful. She was off school a lot. Anyway, she, it turned out later, it took her 8 years to be diagnosed with Lyme. So your story of your daughter who was sick and was seeing doctors and maybe getting, you know, diagnosed with one thing or another, this is a very common story. We hear this a lot at Bay Area Lyme Foundation. And in fact, many of the common misdiagnoses are things like fibromyalgia, lupus, that's another one
that, as well,
that comes up quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Rheumatoid arthritis is another
Rheumatoid arthritis, yeah, absolutely. A lot of people are told, oh, it's in your head, and they get prescribed antidepressants.
What they told her.
That's a classic, of course.
Yeah, that's a classic.
The old bailout, that's in your head.
There's some people who may get misdiagnosed as having MS, and then eventually. So, you know, there's a whole laundry list of very serious, legitimate illnesses and diseases that sometimes people who actually have Lyme or combinations of different kinds of Lyme, as I said, it's a big bucket because there are all these different like co-infections can get thrown in there, which we should...
Toxic mold is one of them.
Yeah, that's another thing that people tend to have a sensitivity about. So it's difficult because what we currently don't have is a really robust and reliable diagnostic tool.
Okay.
And Bay Area Lyme Foundation, we were founded back in 2012, and our mission is to make Lyme disease easy to diagnose and simple to cure.
Okay.
Because currently it can be difficult, very difficult and challenging to diagnose, and it can be difficult and challenging to cure. And there's a lot of reasons for that, which we can go into, and I can kind of throw some light on
that. Yeah, I think
that
would be good, because what I was going to say is really we should go back a step and like how people are probably wondering, if you're not informed, how they get it.
Right.
Like, where does it begin? And the theory, or I don't even know if it's a theory, but I would know from tick bites. And ticks are, you know, when you don't know they're on you, they're burrowing in your skin when you're out walking in high grass or in weeds, or if you go play golf, or if you go hiking, right? These are the places you're going to. Can you talk a little bit about how you get it?
Well, the thing about it is that the ticks are incidental to the process. Just like if you get bitten by a mosquito, you might get bitten by a mosquito that is carrying malaria or West Nile virus or, you know, same thing with ticks.
Is that right?
Yeah, the ticks themselves are just what we call in the world of science a vector.
Okay.
And a vector is just a fancy word for a bridge.
Okay.
Right, so they're just a bridge between the species. And so the bacteria itself that causes Lyme lives inside the bloodstream here in California in small mammals. It will live in voles and mice and rabbits and, you know, just little voles, right? Okay. And so what happens is if you have a tick that's just going about its normal tick business, right? And the ticks, all their drive is about is feeding and breeding. That's it. They don't have any skin in the game at all.
Yeah.
So if you get a tick.
Literally.
Literally. And that tick who's just going about its business waiting for a something that is a mammal to come by. And then it gets on the skin of that mammal and burrows into that mammal and takes a blood meal. And if it happens to feed on a mammal that is carrying the Borrelia burgdorferi infection and that particular bacteria in its blood, then that tick becomes infected.
Okay.
Okay. And then that tick has to have that blood meal in order to metamorphose to its next stage of its life cycle, right?
Okay.
And then now that infected tick, when it goes to the next stage of its life cycle, if a human happens to come into contact with that tick while that tick is just going about its business looking for its next meal, just like we get in the car and drive to Safeway, incidental, that tick gets on you and it will embed itself in its skin. And as it is going about its normal business of feeding, the bacteria in the midgut of the tick becomes activated by ingestion of live mammalian blood.
You're making this tick so fascinating to me. Like, I'm like, that's, I feel so bad for the tick now because you're like, he's just doing what he was born to do and there's nothing. But that's amazing. It's so perfectly put.
Ticks are completely fascinating. And in fact, some of my favorite people in this job to talk to are tick ecologists.
I can't even imagine.
I
get lost in that one.
Encyclopedic.
That's a rabbit hole for me.
They are so fascinating. And what's fascinating about tick ecology is that tick ecology covers so many different kinds of mammals and so many different species of animals. It's not just a one-shot wonder, you know, because they're feeding on deer, they're feeding on rabbits, they're feeding on birds, they're feeding on reptiles, they're feeding on, you know, those ticks, horses, dogs. I mean, if we had kangaroos here in California, they'd be feeding on kangaroos, raccoons, you name
matter.
It.
Just doesn't going matter. Into whatever it needs to get the blood.
Absolutely. Wow. So
quite a host.
It just is all about where the reservoirs of this bacteria are residing. And in that, in when you have like a pocket of, say, a colony of mice or voles or rabbits in a particular geographical location, think about it. That means that if you are testing the ticks along a trail, for example, and say the trail is, I don't know, 5 miles long, but you've got in one piece of that trail, there's a colony of mammals that are all reservoir hosts for this bacteria. That means that the ticks at one end of the trail could be completely clean and totally uninfected.
Right.
And the ticks at the other end could be clean and completely uninfected. But in that small geographical piece of that trail, if you happen to get bitten by a tick in that particular, like, quarter mile or eighth of a mile of that trail where there happens to be an infected community of small mammals, then the chances are that you might get bitten by an infected
Unbelievable.
Tick.
So it really is. I mean, that movie Outbreak, if you remember that back in the day, I remember being like just freaked out by it because I'm like, that's how simple something can happen. Like somebody sneezes in an airport and, you know, that type of thing. But we get bit. I'm East Coaster. You know, we used to have mosquitoes were a part of our lives. You just knew in the summer you're going to have them. You're going to be scratching them all the time. You'd have little scabs from it. It was part of your life. Here I haven't seen a mosquito, thank goodness. But you really are. There's no way to avoid getting bit by a mosquito in New York or New Jersey. You just can't. They're going to bite you. And here there's no humidity, so there's less mosquitoes unless you're close to like ponds or rivers. But my point is it's so easy to be bit. A tick, not quite as easy, but it's a lot easier than you would think. And it's happening to a lot more people than I think anybody ever believed. So we have 10 minutes left, believe it or not, how quickly this goes. Yeah. 30 minutes goes by in a flash here, Joe. But we're going to continue. This is a conversation we will continue, though. We will have you back because this is stages for us. We're really kind of just teaching the basics right now, which I think is good. And then we can delve deeper into this. But did you have something you wanted to ask?
I have a lot of things. Go ahead. There's not enough time to ask all the questions.
Ask one, because I wanted you to jump in.
Instance-wise, as far as infections of Lyme are concerned in the Bay Area, what are we looking at? Do we have any stats for that?
We have statistics for that, but it's not terribly reliable because there are many more people who are infected with Lyme than actually get recorded by the CDC. One thing I do want to say is that Lyme is currently the most common vector-borne disease in the United States today.
Well, that's scary.
And Lyme and ticks are active year-round in California.
I was going to ask that too.
You could get bitten by a tick in December. In California, ticks love the moisture, so they become very active after it rains. So we see spikes here of tick activity and people getting bitten by ticks. It's sort of a different kind of calendar
rainy season
than the East Coast. The other thing is the difference is that on the East Coast, a lot of people get bitten by ticks in what they call peri-domestic situations, which means around the home, in the backyard people gardening, like you said. Okay, in California, it's a little different that the majority of people, we hypothesize, and we do have some data on this, tend to get bitten when they're outdoors recreating, you know, trail running, mountain biking, backpacking, hiking, etc., picnicking, okay? So there are... the United States is a very big country.
Huge. Yeah, it's like 50 different countries.
It is. And so there are definite regionalities. Currently, for example, we know that ticks are responsible for approximately 15 or 16 different illnesses in humans. And different ticks carry different diseases. The black-legged tick, which is the Western black-legged tick, which is the tick that is responsible primarily for Lyme out here in the Western U.S., one tick can actually vector or transmit up to 6 different disease-causing pathogens into humans just from one bite.
One bite.
So, and the way that those different pathogens operate within the tick can be a spectrum as well.
Right.
So some of those things might get transmitted quite slowly over the course of the tick being attached to the person's body, but in other instances, those pathogens or bacteria or parasites or viruses could actually get transmitted quite quickly. And that's an area of massive controversy in the world of Lyme is speed of transmission.
Yeah, so. That was something I was definitely going to touch on. Seeing as we're time situation here, is there anything that you absolutely wanted to mention?
Prevention.
Most important thing, right?
Let's get to
if you don't have it, how do you?
Let's do the money shot.
Let's do the money shot. What do we got? Tell us
Here's what we've got. The absolute top priority for tick-borne disease prevention is to check yourselves for ticks every day if you have been anywhere outside that you think could be tick habitat. Mm-hmm. So, and it's not just long grasses. Like you mentioned golf earlier. A lot of people who play golf, you know, even on mown grass, if they go into the rough, you know.
Yeah,
it tick check every day. The best time to do it is when you're in the shower at the end of the day, and you've got a massive amount of nerve endings in your fingertips. The fingertip test is the best way. In a lot of ways that people will find a tick is they'll be soaping mm-hmm. their underarms or washing themselves, and then they'll feel a little bump. Mm-hmm. And it'll feel like a skin tag or a mole or something that was not there yesterday.
Right.
If you feel something like that, you investigate, okay? The second thing is, if you are out and about, wear long pants, long sleeves, tuck your hair up into your cap if you have long hair, tuck your pants into your socks in order to prevent the ticks crawling into, you know, clothing. The really great way to take the next step to prevent tick bites is to treat your clothing with a commonly available treatment, which is a chemical called permethrin. And you can buy this online from Amazon. You can get it in outdoor shops.
In an Ayurvedic world, are you sure people are going to want to put a chemical on them?
Well, I'm going to come to that. If you don't feel good about chemicals, you can buy natural alternatives like lemon eucalyptus oil, Repel and NaturePel. They do more natural things, not
That's
chemicals.
Good. Okay.
However, even if you spray your clothing with chemicals or natural products, oils, etc., if you have exposed skin, it's recommended that you use minimum a 20% DEET to repel the ticks.
20%.
And then children are most at risk for contracting Lyme. The hypothesis is that because their stature, they're close to the ground, they're climbing trees, rolling around in leaves, etc. And so it's very important if you have small children that you tick check every day. And if you do get bitten, you should remove the tick as soon as possible, use a special tick removing tool or needle nose tweezers.
Yeah, I was going to say tweezers.
Grasp the tick as close to the skin as possible and pull it straight out. Do not, under any circumstances, do any of the following things.
Okay.
Put a lit cigarette under it. Put a match under it. Cover it with Vaseline. Put duct tape on it. Scrape it off with a credit card. Squish it. Don't do any of those things. Pull it out with tweezers or a tool. Save the tick. Because if you start to develop symptoms, you can get that tick tested, and that you will be able to find out whether the tick has
It's a lot to process, because most people do not go through these steps in their own, because people are always in hasty and you know, and they don't want to be bothered. But this is like the easiest way to deal with this is not get it.
Exactly.
Right? And if you can do little things now.
Yes.
But like you said, a tick tool. Like, I doubt anybody in the world that I know is going to have this tick tool. But if they do have tweezers, that's
tweezers.
Good to know. We most of us have
needle nose, not the flat ones, needle nose tweezers.
Yeah.
One thing I just want to say, though, before I go, I don't know if I was allowed to say this or not because we didn't talk about it, but we have a ton of information and prevention tips on our website.
Oh, of course I want you. I was going to go to this. So tell us the website and info.
It's bayarealyme.org.
Mm-hmm.
Bay Area Lyme, L-Y-M-E. Mm. And we have... We're an evidence-based science organization. We're primarily, we fund medical research all over the country. Like more than 80% of our budget goes to funding postdoctoral research into Lyme and tick-borne diseases around the country.
Okay.
So prevention, which is my little sliver of it, is hugely important, though, because the more we teach people about how to prevent tick bites, the more we can help bring a close to this.
That's a great point. And I will, before I throw it to Larry to close out the show, I would say to you that you said there's an event coming up in Evergreen or something.
Oh, yeah, in February. And it will be posted on our website under
events.
We have
something coming up in Carmel.
Yeah, you said
there
was something in Carmel too.
Oh, yeah, in Carmel on September the 25th.
Yeah.
We have a public event. All of our public events are free. And it's at the Woman's Club in downtown Carmel from 6 till 8:30 on September the 25th.
That's on your website as well?
It is on our website,
Bay Area Lyme, L-Y-M-E.org. You can get all this.
Yes.
You're coming back, I will promise you, because I know we didn't even scratch the surface.
No, we barely tickled it.
Yeah, we tickled it today. That's all right. It's a good. We needed a tickle. And then the next time we really will have a deeper
How much time do we have?
Very little. But do what you gotta do.
Insurance, as far as people that are already infected, this is a major thing. What do we do?
All right, well, Larry, we don't have time for that.
We don't.
I'll tell you, we have 40 seconds. I thought you were going to ask the final.
That's a 30-minute conversation.
Listen, let's, we can have you in very soon. We'll talk about that off the air. You're coming back very soon if you're available.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that because that is a huge part of it.
It is. It
massive.
Really is.
So I promise. Go ahead, your other thing I thought you were going to do when you threw me off.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's too late for that, right?
No, just do it.
Oh. What would you leave our listeners with right now, if you could?
I would say that not every tick is infected. It's very important to really not freak out if you get bitten by a tick. And collectively, we sort of estimate that maybe about 10 to 15% of adult ticks here in California are infected with something. It might not just be Borrelia burgdorferi. It might be one of those other co-infections. Nasty, nasty stuff. Mm-hmm. But the most risky season is around May, April, May time, which is, we call that nymph season, which is when the teenage ticks come out.
Okay.
And then like anything, teenagers are trouble.
You're really humanizing these ticks and scaring me because I'm like, don't, that poor teenage tick, he's going through so many things.
We shouldn't really blame him, but that's when the big spike happens is nymph season in the springtime.
I'm going to cut you off.
Yeah.
I don't mean to do that.
It's all right.
This is Joe Ellis, Bay Area Lyme Foundation, who's been so helpful. We're going to have you back guaranteed.
Okay.
Joe, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you. You were great. Larry, you were very good. I wouldn't say great, but you were very good. And we'll be back next week, another edition of People Helping People. And like I said, within a couple of weeks, Joe will be back to finish what we started, or at least continue what we started today.
Thank you. Check every day, people.
BayAreaLyme.org. We'll see you next week on People Helping People.